over the next, I would say, 12 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, we're going to try to identify, I would say, probably 20, 25, 30 major aspects of religion, identity, religious identity and consciousness, moral composition. These are the parshas that I hope to use to really help you build that identity as a Ben Torah, as an Oved Hashem. What are the values? What are the goals? Who are the role models? How are we to try to draw from these people and their lives of inspiration and their inspired lives, guidance for our own development, for our own growth? Let's start tonight with a comparison of two generations. The generation that was flooded off this earth, and the sin and the failure of that generation is fairly obvious. This is a generation of complete and total moral collapse, complete and total degeneracy. Despite all their prosperity, and Chazal tells us that they enjoyed supernatural prosperity, they only had to plan. Can I ask you, Alex, to close the door? They only had to plant once in 40 years. And the harvest would sustain them for 40 years. Could you imagine working one every 40 years of your life? What type of prosperity and welfare they envisioned? And ironically, it led to a complete and total moral breakdown and a quick plunge into chaos. Ki malah aretz chamas. They stole from one another, which is itself astounding, astonishing. Remember about 15 years ago, there's a scandal in the United States city, centered in the United States city of Houston. Houston is an energy hub. There are a lot of corporations there that got very wealthy based on providing energy, primarily oil. And it was known as the Enron scandal. And there were these chief executives who were guilty of embezzling millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of corporate funds, and large corporations were sunk. And at some point they interviewed some of these corporate chiefs and they said, I don't understand something. You had enough money for yourself, for your children, for your grandchildren, for four or five generations, and you forfeited it all, you imperiled it all by trying to steal and embezzle? And they said, in some very, very bizarre fashion, yeah, but I didn't have as much as the next person. And it became a rivalry beyond any natural or normal need-based rivalry or aspiration, just to have more, just to... It always reminds me of the Mabul. How many people lived in that world? This is an ancient world. This is a world that was very vulnerable. How many people lived? Maybe just, Joan, ask it to be a little quieter because it's making noise. Okay, just to move away. Thanks. How many people, put them on the back table so people can get, put them on the back table. How many people lived in that world? A few million? A few hundred million? Certainly can't imagine a world populated to the degree that it's populated today. Presumably, there were enough natural resources for absolute equitable spread. So why did people cheat and steal? Where did this come from? At a certain point, either you lead a disciplined, self-contained life of contentment, or you're always looking for more. You're always looking for more possessions. You're always looking for more opportunities. There's a very thin line, and we'll talk about it this year in this room, between being ambitious and being aspirational, and wanting to grow and to develop, and between being so solicitous and desirous of opportunities beyond your natural means, that your life is spent in endless, quixotic pursuit of castles you shouldn't be pursuing and of ideals you shouldn't be trying to acquire. And how do you draw that line between healthy ambition and between monstrous ambition? And you just get the sense that they weren't able to draw that line. They lived in a supernatural world. Could you imagine? They lived for 900 years, and they planted once every 40, and still they broke down all boundaries, and that led into adultery, where they exchanged wives, or they stole each other's wives. So you get the sense of a complete moral chaos and a complete moral vacuum. And Hashem didn't just remove the inhabitants. He had to reboot the entire planet. They had to erase all remnants and all memories and all stench of this generation, to rebuild a different world, a fallen world, but still one that could be sustained through a level of morality they were unable to maintain. But the parsha is bracketed by two generations. It's very clear the Torah wants to draw our attention to the contrast between Dor Midbar and the Dor HaFlaga, the Dor Migdal Bavel. Why were they punished? What was their crime? What made them so criminal and insidious that there's an entire generation that gets punished. This isn't punishing an individual such as Adam or Cain. This is a whole different narrative. This is a complete shift from the narrative of Bereishis, where an individual, of course, the only individual on the planet, but an individual disobeys a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Cain, the only child, murders his brother. But you have whole scale, we'd call it collective punishment. It wasn't collective punishment in a way that was unjustifiable. The entire generation had sunk into that condition. Chazal were aware that the failure of Migdal Bavel is not as obvious. Source number Gimel. Maisador HaMabol Nisparish. Maisador HaFlaga Lo Nisparish. The crimes of the Dor HaFlaga are not explicit, which requires us to delve and to probe a little more gingerly to try to find the failure of the Dor of Migdal Bavel. Now let's jump to the finish line. Then hopefully I'll describe how Chazal got to the finish line. Chazal were well aware that the Dor of Migdal Bavel were not innocent, they weren't innocuous. Chazal impugned to them and described them as committing heresy, atheism, the rejection of God, battling HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, source number Gimel. Amru, they said, Lo kol heimenu, lover lo es elyonim. We don't allow him to command the skies, v'lita lanu es hatachtonim, and just offer us the ground. Elabo v'nasalo migdal. Let's make a tower. Let's go battle him in his own terrain. It's always important to take the battle to the enemy. Instead of waiting for him to attack us, remember, these were people who were scarred with the traumatic memories of the mumble. So this isn't just a rebellion or an insurrection in a vacuum. These are people who fear another divine assault, another divine attack. Instead of waiting for that attack and trying to guard ourselves, let's enter his realm and do battle. Nasalenu Migdal, let's create a tower. Source number Gimel. V'nitzan avodah zarah b'rosho. We'll erect an idol on the top of that tower. V'natzan cherev v'yada, that idol will hold a sword. V'tehinirus, and that will rally us to a war against this militant, angry God. Or, as Rabbi Elazar Reb Shimon said, source number Vav, Hesiu atzma mikadmona shel olam. When they traveled, and we'll talk about their travel in a moment, they traveled away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. E.F. Sheino, we don't want Lobo, we don't want his presence. V'alo v'aluhuso, source number Vav, part 1. We don't want his dominion or his authority. How did Chazal get here? The description of Migdal Bavel is very, not just generic, but favorable. What's missing? How did Chazal impute to them all these theological crimes, heresy, atheism, warring with God, rejecting Hashem's authority? So let's read Migdal Bavel a little bit more carefully. Let's read the text itself and see what we can glean from the text. Take a look at Source 1, Part Aleph. Just read the words which the Torah employs to describe Migdal Bavel. Vayi kol aretz safa achas udvarim achadim. This seems very, very laudable, very commendable. Unity, fraternity, harmony, common language, common purpose, not just one language linguistically, but one purpose, one set of goals, one agenda, dvarim achadim. Certainly, when viewed against the backdrop of the violence of Bereishis between Cain and Hevel, the complete collapse into moral disregard of Dor HaMabul, where people knew no boundaries and they didn't seem to enable collective activity or harmonious living, this is a redemptive moment. One language, one agenda, Dvarim Achadim, Vayhi ben Aslam Mikedem, Vayimtzu Bicha Be'eretz Shinar. This is even more impressive. They're traveling. The literal translation is they're traveling. They're not committing heresy, as Chazal reinterpreted it. They're traveling. They're traveling from the east. So they're traveling westward. Benasam mikedem. By the way, whenever someone travels in Tanakh westward, where are they heading towards? The land of Israel. They're traveling from the eastern part of the hemisphere, westerly. So they're moving closer to Eretz Yisrael. We don't know where they began their journey from. But presumably somewhere in that, in the area that the Teva landed in, the Har Ararat, somewhere in the northeast of Israel, and they're moving westerly, perhaps southerly, towards Eretz Israel. So this activity is taking place in modern-day Iraq, Iran, Syria, maybe some of the Central Asia areas. But more importantly, until this point, human beings are condemned to a life of nomadic wandering. Navanatiya Bharats. You'll barely raise cattle, and all your travel will be to find new pasture lands and new hills to graze upon. Here, people are traveling to find a more hospitable, clement, comfortable place to live. There's a group, not individuals. They're traveling together, and they're selecting a location to build a city based on climate, based on resources, based on protection. This is actually city planning, group dynamics, urbanization. Let's build a city and let's choose a location that meets all the expectations. So this is not just joint activity and solidarity, but it's also human beings acting in a way that's pre-planned, premeditated, calculating in a manner that animals can. Animals travel, they migrate for food, they migrate for mating, they migrate for protection. Here, human beings are planning in a sophisticated, articulate, coherent fashion. Let's plan the city. And they find this place called Shinar. And they live there together. Not as individuals, not in isolation, but as a group. Now it gets even more interesting because we get a front row at the city planning sessions. So we've seen them adopting a joint language, a common interest and a common agenda. Vayamru eshel reyehu. It's an interesting word. It's actually friendship, collegiality, partnership, conversation, communication. Vayomu eshel reyehu. It's the first time that human beings speak to one another in ways that aren't threatening or accusatory or in some ways deceitful. Chava implicates Adam in her conversation. Cain and Hevel exchange harsh words. Lamech speaks to his wives. And this is joint communication in ways that are positive and progressive. Actually talking to one another. Vayemu yishoreu. Chava. Here's the key word in this section. The milah mancha. Hava always means, as Rashi says, look at source base, hazminu atzmechem. Before taking action, let's plan. Let's strategize. Let's gather our resources. Let's plan our activities. This isn't impetuous. This isn't rash or hasty. Hava. Let's think. Let's plan. Rashi. Kol hava lashon hazmana. Shemichinim atzmam. They prepare themselves. What do we hope? Let's just build a house. You plan, blueprints, engineering, designs, gathering resources. It's a major operation. You prepare for the project. Mischabim l'malacha, let's gather and join efforts to work. L'etza, for an idea, for an agenda. L'masa, for a project, for a journey. Hava, they say. Nilbana levenim. Now it gets interesting. Why are bricks so important? Because this is a valley. In a valley, there are no stones. Stones are typically found in mountainous regions. This is a very, very comfortable, green, meadow-filled valley. No problem with no stones. So naturally, without stones, you build homes from hardened mud or from reeds, bamboo reeds. Then one problem. Those homes can't withstand the flood. They can't withstand the flood on two fronts. First of all, because the material will be washed away. In the case of mud, will dissolve. Second of all, because those materials don't support multi-story buildings. You can't build a multi-story mud hut. The bottom mud won't sustain the top story. It will collapse. It's hard to build a multi-story reed. It would just be too light. So here, they're extremely vulnerable in this valley to the flash floods of the next expected mabul. And that was clearly their expectation. Rashi completes that expectation. Source Dalet. Amru, they said, Achas li elef, the tough reish nun vavshanim, once every 1,666 years, that's more or less when they were living, harakia mismotate, the heavens collapse, and the watery copious deluge overcomes us. Kesheim sh'asa b'meha mabul, bo v'nasa lo smuchos, let's support the heavens with the tower, but not just support the heavens with the tower so that it won't collapse, but prepare ourselves and gird ourselves against the impending flood, the inevitable flood. So creating bricks, levanim, is a major achievement in human history. We take it for granted. We live in a mountainous region, so in Israel in general, most of the homes are externally coated with stone, but most of you come from areas in which they're not stone-faced, but they're brick-faced. And this may be to avoid fire, but it's a similar protection against the invasion of elements of wind and water and cold. There's only one problem. In order to create mortar and bricks, you have to harness fire. Fire is a divinely delivered gift. According to the Gemara in Yerushalmi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers fire to Adam after Shabbos, after that first week. Shabbos was completely illuminated, so there's no darkness on Shabbos. Now it's Matzei Shabbos, the first Matzei Shabbos of creation. Adam is frightened by the impending darkness. Hashem delivers fire. When will man finally learn to harness the power of fire? Light, creativity, heat, energy, production. Here it is. You are looking at the first industrial revolution in the history of man. This is the first time the man learns to harness technology of the day at his disposal and to improve his lifestyle. And it requires public planning, common purpose. What are some of the inventions, so to speak, of the industrial revolution? Factory, assembly line, interchangeable parts. In order to produce at a mass level, you have to have a level of cooperation, solidarity, planning, and of course energy to fuel this entire process. That's what you're looking at. You're looking at the first industrial revolution. It seems very quaint and very pristine, but in those days it was a major leap forward. Hava nilbana levinim, let's create these bricks. The nisrafa lisrafa, of course we'll have to create furnaces to burn this ground or mud like material sediment into actual bricks. And they succeed. Vati lahem halaveina le'evin. They employ these bricks in place of stones, which they don't have access to. V'achemar, and the material that they had also forged in the fire, v'yalem l'chomer, they use as mortar. So now they've got bricks and mortar. And they can build homes that are stable enough to withstand floods and stable enough to support multi-story residences, which is important because they can now live one second in an urban setting. They can now live on top of one another and increase the concentration of population, which is in and of itself a form of protection, to learn, to live together in herds, in large groups. When Cain is condemned to be Navanat Yevar, it's part of his fear is that he'll be overwhelmed by the animal kingdom, that they will overwhelm him. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, although you'll be alone, I'll create some magical deterrent that the animals won't attack you. One second, let's just finish the description. Vayamru, now their next stage of planning, again, Hava, there's the appearance of that word a second time. Hava, Nivna Lanu Ir, we've got the material, got the common interest, got the capacity to support large populations. Let's build a city. Think of the modern city. I'll talk about the invention of the modern city and the challenges that it triggered in the modern era. Sanitation, transportation, food, water, clean water. It's not simple to build a city. We're facing other challenges in the modern city. But this is the first city in the history of mankind. The first appearance of a city. Not herds, not tents, not nomads. A city. People living together harmoniously. Umigdal, the tower. Why is a tower important? Well, it's important at a practical level so people from a distance will be able to make their way to the city. Presumably, most of the people who will use the tower as a landmark before GPS and before they learn how to navigate through the heavenly planets, presumably it's visitors. They're looking to call other people to live with them. They have a social consciousness. Let's create a city and let's invite people to live with us. People who live in the vicinity of Shinar, Bava won't need the tower. I mean, you'll need it for navigation, but it's to herald people, to beckon people, to call them to this city. The Nasa Lomashay, they want to publicize the city. Pen Nafos, up in Akal Arts, because if we just live haphazardly and randomly, we'll live in isolation, we'll live in small, narrow little communities of tents, we'll be scattered. These are people who are struggling through human ingenuity, through human solidarity, through human imagination, to basically reverse the curse of Cain. To climb out of that curse and that condemnation of Navanat Tiebaritz with all that it entails, violence, disunity, aggression, vulnerability, nomadic, they're creating, through harmony, common language, common interest, the first great city. This is a momentous occasion. How did Chazal trace these achievements to heresy, to battling against the Kodesh Baruch Hu?
because I'll see a clear association. Source number hey. In Nechemi Omer, Mi garam lahem she'imridu bi? What caused these people to rebel against Hashem? Lo al yedei she'im am echad v'safa achad. Because of the unity, because of the accomplishments. What are we looking at? Who had a question before? Oh, yes.
When they're doing all this stuff where they're creating the first city and the first fire, or using fire for the first industrial revolution, so to speak, is that after the flood or before?
After. This is all after the flood.
This is all, okay.
To prevent the next flood.
Well, because you kept saying prevent the next flood, but I thought Hashem said there will be no more.
They doubted him. They thought it was inevitable. Yes?
Just you said that the people were kind of touched on the marble before. Wasn't it that the marble destroyed, killed all of them?
But they heard the stories. It was part of their collective memory. They were aware. They didn't experience it, but they were aware of the stories that the children of Noah told their children. This is the story of stories. Sitting around the campfire in the middle of the woods, they want to tell a scary story. This is the story. You don't have to make up fake stories of ghosts. There you have it. A flood that completely overwhelmed humanity. What you're looking at is a generation where human beings equip themselves and empower themselves to overwhelm and overcome the vulnerabilities of living in natural world, to overcome the fragility of human experience. We've achieved the prowess. We've equipped ourselves technologically, collectively. Sound familiar? Listen, I thought I had a question. Sound familiar? Let me tell you two quotes to help frame this conversation. Because we live in a modern world. We live more, in many respects, in a world of Migdal Bavel than we live in a world of Dora Mabel. We're the beneficiaries of hundreds of years of industrialization, of technology, of great, courageous, unprecedented, dramatic leap forward for mankind in all sectors of human experience. Before man has the skill to move mountains, he requires the faith to move mountains. When man acquires the skill to move mountains, he no longer is as reliant on faith. He's less in touch with his own dependability and vulnerability. Or to say it otherwise, as man becomes more godlike, God becomes more manlike. And that's the trap of human progress and human advance. To try to stabilize our world, advance it, because this is the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'll speak about this extensively next week and the week after. One of the hallmarks of Judaism, it is Hashem's will that human beings should live in prosperity and welfare and health. Hashem does not want us to live deprived, vulnerable, suffering lives. Hashem wants the march of science and technology is triggered by the religious impulse of a Jew to rectify and improve this world. L'saki in olam b'malchus shakai is not just to improve the world theologically, but to advance it in every sector. And throughout history, Jews have been the vanguard of scientific development, commercial development, economic advance, political enlightenment. Because that's our calling, is Ovdei Hashem, to improve this world, to reshape it in the image of the Ribono Shel Olam. But that could obscure the basic sense of dependency and fragility that's at the heart of our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's at the heart of our reliance, it's at the heart of our faith, it's at the heart of our hierarchy. Al misecha shebuchal yamimanu, al niflo secha v'tav secha shebuchaleis, erev avokev etzarem. So if you're walking around Europe in the medieval era, and you escape the Black Plague for dozens of years, you say modem and it resonates with great accuracy. Everyone around me is dying. No one has a clue. There's no medicine or science that can heal this Black Plague. And somehow I've survived. Al misecha shebuchal yamimanu. I'm eking out a living in some forgotten country in the middle of who knows. I'm farming my land and barely getting out a living. The Gentiles around me are harassing and murdering. And I escape it. Baruch Hashem, Yisrael Shebuchal Yomimano, not just Jews and humanity at large. But now we live in a world that seems very stable. And it deludes us into visions of invincibility and invulnerability. And even when we are vulnerable, we look to ourselves for solutions. Let me give you two examples. I was born in the 60s. Which means I spent most of the 70s traveling to doctor's offices getting shots and injections and infusions, because this was the great rallying of humanity to try to solve all the microbial diseases.
diseases you may have heard of, you probably got one shot maybe early on in school, but these were the diseases that we were struggling with. And I remember doctors taking out needles that looked like harpoons. That's how big they looked to me. Every week or so, we're going to eliminate smallpox, and we're going to eliminate chicken pox, and mumps, and measles, and probably have heard of these. How many people you know got mumps? We actually knew people with bumps and polio, and probably still see older people who suffered from some of these. And all of a sudden, in that window of about 5-10 years, which we really deceived ourselves into thinking we had conquered the microbial world, that we now had that world at its heels and we could control. And of course, in the 1980s, AIDS broke out. We still really haven't solved that virus. We will at a certain stage. But it reminded us, it had many, many connotations, cultural connotations beyond the medical and scientific consequences, obviously. But it reminded us of how vulnerable we really are to a world we can't see with the naked eye. Let me give you another example. The post-World War II era in Western civilization was very jubilant, very buoyant, and very confident. Because throughout the first part of the 20th century, two major threats had imperiled the free world. And the combination of big business and big government, in each case, had defeated those threats. The Nazis, communists, the war, the great war of World War I.
Why did the Allies ultimately triumph? Because of the United States industry, the mobilization of the United States industrial machinery to provide arms and weapons. And you've all seen the posters, you've all read. There was a sense that any problem that afflicts our world and our society we can deal with, this combination, we can land the man on the moon. And then it became very, very stable, very, very secure. In ways that in Israel it never really was. So having lived in Israel for part of that time, I was able to compare and contrast the cultural milieu of where I had grown up to the cultural milieu in Israel, which was always fighting for its survival and struggling to advance. And then, of course, the major tectonic shift, the major shift of consciousness, September 11th. September 11th, obviously, was an infamous day. People lost their lives, panic, terror. You can't understate that. But beyond that, there was a shift in the Western imagination. Our world isn't as secure as we thought. The financial system upon which we build so much of our confidence and our progress can be dismantled in a flash. People's lives can be lost, and of course, the terror that ensued since then. And in some ways, obviously not in any way physically or militaristic, it's a more dangerous world to live in. But from a religious and existential point, you're more in touch with your own vulnerability, your own mortality. There's less of this veneer of invincibility to know how precious life is, how quickly it can be taken, how uncertain our world is in a certain way. Remember, the people who live until Dor HaFlagon is a very interesting shift. If you look at the last section of Noach, right before Dor HaFlagon, I think before Dor HaFlagon, I don't have a chumash in front of me, where they're listing the genealogy from Noach before Dor HaFlagon. People are living 900 years. They're living about 400 years before they have children, another 400 or 500 years after they have children. Until Peleg, until this Dor HaFlagon, he lives close to 200-300 years. It's a dramatic decline, the amount of years they live. When I was young, I was always very jealous of these people. Wow, 900 years, 800 years. Sometimes too much time. It was very, very disorienting, confusing. Some of you are back in bed as modern, you probably appreciate that. But in a larger scale, obviously, a healthy sense and identification of human mortality, of an end point, of death. Part of life is living with the prospect of death, not in a morbid sense, not in a way that's pessimistic and that's obsessed with death. Not dark or gothic, but in a healthy sense that this is not endless. It has to reach some terminus and you have to prepare for that. And this is a life that has to be examined and filled with content. And it seems like they have too much time on their hands. In part because of the industrialization. Because it had eliminated some of the struggles of facing the natural elements. That's really the challenge of the Dor HaFlagon. To advance our world, to improve our world, to equip our world, to empower humanity. Without becoming obsessed, without divinizing human beings, without deifying human beings. without eliminating the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's really what Chazal are seeing. We have a solution to the flood. Well, what's our solution to the flood? Come say to him, David. Their solution to the flood was twofold. Let's build sturdier homes. Let's build a tower to reinforce the heavens. Some comical fashion. Let's war with God. It's probably symbolic. They weren't warring with God. They were creating enough military confidence. They no longer needed God. They had their own tower. The tower was the icon of their confidence. That's what Chazal are sensing in the Migdal Bavel. Source number Zion. Amar Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer preempted me on this year, comparing the two generations. Amar Rabbi Eliezer. Ezo kasha. What's more odious? Zesha Omer Lamelech, O Ani, O Atabeplatin. The person turns to the king and says, I don't want to live with you. You want to live in the palace? I'll find somewhere else to live. You want me to live in the palace? I'll live in the palace. That's the door Mabul. They accepted Hashem's authority. Just didn't want to be near Hashem. Just turn your face away from me. I don't want you to look at all my immoral behavior. I want to cheat. I want to steal. I want to murder. I want to commit adultery. Now you're opposed to it. You find your space. I find my space. You stay in heaven. I'll stay on there. I'm fine with that. Oh, Zesha Omer, or someone that says, Ani beplatin v'lo ata. I want to be in the heavens. Remember what they said? It's not fair that he commands the heavens and we command the earth and he chooses indiscriminately or arbitrarily just to rain down his waters of rage on us every 1600 years. Let's go to the heavens and strip him of his authority and battle for dominion of the heavens. Zek kasha sha'omer lesar, the last line, Ani beplatin v'lo ata. The Dharmabal. They didn't care. They accepted Hashem's authority. They just didn't want to operate under that authority. They were too debased. The Dor HaFlaga had reached such industrialization, they eliminated the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They no longer needed God. Because that's the challenge today. To live in a world that's so advanced, with such technological, great leaps of science, and to engage in that world. Those who criminalize or demonize technology, people who see anything modern as dangerous, as toxic, as hostile, so you're engaged in it and with it. I think there's something on the floor, Andy. I think maybe is there a tar on that placard? Okay. You engage with it in a very, very minimal fashion. As little as necessary. I remember about 20 years ago being on a plane, and a very educated chassid, we're having a conversation about the internet. 20 years ago, 15 years ago. He had very little technological background, so I was explaining to him how the internet operated, what a computer was. It wasn't some little man in the computer giving answers. I was explaining to him the entire concept of information flow. And then I turned to him. He's very educated. So I had a very pleasant conversation with him. He said, do you understand that in 20 years you won't be able to function without an internet connection? You're going to pay your bills, get directions, order. He says, you may be right, but at least I'll buy 20 years of safety. 20 years of insularity. It's very important not to dismiss or to deprecate other people's views. And that's one advantage of delaying technological adaptation. But we're all people that adapt it and that endorse it and that implement it. I think I was one of the first people. In 1994, the internet was very raw. 1995, I realized I could share a serious Torah and open the halls of Lumbus to people who aren't able to step foot in a yeshiva, either physically or they haven't had the opportunity, they no longer have the opportunity. I've shared over 630 high-level Lumbus shiurim, and then, of course, in later years, when the internet as a Torah enabler became even more obvious. So we're people who don't see the world in black and white, we don't see the world as demons and angels, and we're engaged in that world. But understand the subtle whispers that are dangerous when you engage in the world of progress and science and adaptation. And are you constantly aware of your vulnerability, of your fragility? It's not incidental that the world of the internet, and that's really what has advanced humanity. Over the last 20, 30 years, very little has been invented. What has been invented since 1990? New chemicals. New forms of energy, that's the next stage. The person that discovers recyclable energy, renewable energy, that will advance humanity. I can promise you, your grandchildren will say, come on, Zadie. You pour fossil fuels into a car and create a combustion to transport from location to location. That's so primordial. That's so That's so caveman. You actually took fossil fuels. And you, what does that even mean? There was a container in the automobile and you pour it. How did you pour it in? Isn't it greasy and oily? And try to explain to them what a gas station was. And I promise you, because we'll find some renewable energies and cleaner energy source. They'll look at you like you're from Mars or the fossil fuels. But very little has been invented over the last... How has society leapt forward so dramatically? The internet. The ability to exchange information rapidly and relatively effortlessly. Information is powerful. And the exchange of information is empowering. And the internet could only have evolved in the wake of a 150-year process which created a universal language called English. The internet is a direct consequence of the British Empire. It's probably the last British Empire. Because the British Empire universalized one language, and the information highway needs a standard language. So the internet has adapted to the stage where information is presented in multiple languages, but the skeleton has to be one common language, or else the communication will fail. So it's already progressed beyond the need for one language, but you can't create an internet without one language. This is exactly Dormit Albav. He Sapa Chasid Vari Machadim. They have one language, ability to collaborate and to partner with one another because of that one language, and they transcend the need for some higher being. And to demonstrate how fragile it is, all HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is pull out one component. He doesn't flood them. He doesn't overturn them as he does to stone. He just pulls out that common language. He confuses their language. And all comes tumbling down. All comes collapsing around us. And he reminds them how fragile they are. As much as you think you can build the great towers of achievement without that common language, which is so elusive, solidarity and unity. So when we read Parshas Noach, it's the Dor HaMabul, it's very dramatic, very exciting. You can't get excited by people suffering, but certainly very intriguing and tantalizing. But I don't think we live in the Dor HaMabul. Don't let people tell you that. Thank God we have a relatively reasonable moral standard in our world, Baruch Hashem. It rises and dips, crests and troughs, better moments, worser moments, but we're not living in a completely depraved society, wanton assaults on human property and boundaries and marriages and family. We're living more or less in a stable, just, civil society, Baruch Hashem. But we are living in the Dor HaMigdal Babel. And getting caught up in that excitement and that geist of technology sometimes places too much emphasis on man, in some ways obscures us to a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's talk about something else. Since we're talking about language, let's talk about another less global, but just as important aspect of language. The Torah describes the animals who entered the Teva. Source number 2, part days. And of course, Noah has to admit every single species. He's regenerating the animal kingdom, the animal population. So he has to collect every single species. And the Torah reminds us, min ha-behima ha-tahara, from the animals that are kasha, or min ha-behima, or the natural antonym of tahara be, ha-tameya, those animals that are not edible, that are not kosher. And the Torah avoids writing the word tameya. Min ha-behima, asher einena tahara. The animals that are not tahar, they're tame. Now, we happen to be learning Bava Kamma this year. And Bava Kamma is very, very deeply anchored in the biblical text, in the Torah. Almost every daf you read, you're dealing with a halacha that stems from a pasuk, from an extra letter, from an extra word. So the association between the Torah's text and Chazal's interpretation is very, very obvious. But I could teach you, we could visit Masechtos, which are basically hinged upon one or two letters. The Gemara lists certain mesechtos that are parchos ba'avir, that basically have very little psukim. The Torah is very, very careful. This is a theme alert. We're going to talk about this a lot. The Torah is very, very careful not to waste words. Every letter, every jot and tittle, everything has a purpose. Every crown. And we'll see several instances in Sefer Bereishis where the Torah is very verbose, and we'll have to ask ourselves why. What's the message when the Torah seems to deprive certain massive halachic areas of any textual reference, and then spends 80 psukim on Eliezer's visit to Aram Naharaim, or 70 psukim on the genealogy of Asa. Well, think about this. But here's an example, not as grandiose, but certainly as striking, where the Torah wastes a few letters. Instead of writing Habeima HaTumea, which is four letters, the Torah writes Min HaBeima, Asher, three, Einena, five, eight, Tehora, four. Instead of four, it's 12. 11, depending on how you spell it. Why is the Torah wasting so many letters describing the animals entering the ark? Entering the Teva? The answer is the Torah is teaching us how to speak. I want everyone to listen carefully. Onkelos interprets Salam Elokim, that trait which divides us or distinguishes us from animals, as nefesh memalala. We are beings who speak. As I mentioned before, alluded to, many animals communicate. But we communicate our emotions, our visions, our plans, our hopes, sophisticated communication, our math equations, our view of the universe. Animals communicate migratory patterns, defense mechanisms, the availability of food. We communicate in a sophisticated and eloquent fashion. We write poetry, we sing songs, we create art with our speech. We create joy and light and happiness with our speech, and we speak positively to others. So how do you use your tongue? When I say tongue, I don't just mean your tongue, I mean your pen or your computer keyboard as well. It's really the mark of how noble you are as a human being. Now, I want to tell you something I'm not going to talk about tonight, to demarcate it from what I will talk about tonight. The Gemara tells us, and we spoke about this in Elul, we had a presentation about it, source number Aleph, Amar Reb Chanan bar Rava, Hakol Yodim Lama Kala Nichnas Aluchop. Everyone knows why people get married. They're not at home playing backgammon. Everyone knows why people get married. Not a secret. But Kala Menabel Piv, they describe it graphically, and you indulge in it, and you think about it in graphic terms. It's called Nibble Peh. Filth, in our jargon, pornography. Present a presentation today, probably one of the greatest challenges, not the challenge of our generation, because of the accessibility factor. The Rambam writes, why is Hebrew called Lashon HaKodesh? Why is Lashon HaKodesh? Language is a human convention in the Rambam's world. Why is it Lashon HaKodesh? So the Rambam says, because there are no words in the Hebrew language describing the sexual act. A verb doesn't exist. It's all euphemisms. V'adam yada eschafa. Vayishkav is, they lie down together. They knew each other. That's the Rambam up to. Yeah, but everyone knows what Yada Eschava means. They didn't meet each other for ice cream shakes. Vayishkav is Bila. They didn't go to a movie together. So what difference does it make whether I describe it directly or indirectly? The answer is, words clothe our thoughts. The more words we have at our disposal, the sharper and more coherent our thoughts are. Eskimos have 9 words for snow. Because snow is such a vital part of their lives. They have to distinguish between powdery snow and icy snow and watery snow. Not being an Eskimo, I can't really describe 7 or 9 shades of snow, but evidently they can. Try writing a word list of 100 words and then conducting a conversation with your roommate or your chavrusa without veering beyond those 100 words. You'll sound like a caveman. So it's important to have a good vocabulary because the ability to conjure words sharpens our thought and our experiences. So when I employ a word, I'm accessing an experience. If I hold this up, it's the first word that comes to your mind, cup. You think in words. So the fact that there's no word in Hebrew to describe the sexual activity means that in everyone's mind there's still... It's slight, it's subtle, but there's a euphemistic jump. I say the word lie, and then I know what the word lie means, and I associate it. But even that association is less direct and less graphic. I say to Adam Nuchav, okay, I know what it is. It's very quick. The synapses are already developed, but it's still a synaptic jump. I still have to make a leap. But then there's another form of how you employ your tongue. And it may have been articulated to you with the wrong terminology, because it's the classic terminology, I understand why, but it's an absolute mistake, and you have to realize it as something autonomous and something in some not just as dangerous as pornography, but a different danger. When a person curses, curse words, I would not call that pornography. I would not call that nibble peh. Unfortunately, curse words have become so preponderant that they've lost any association with whatever sexual activity they once conveyed. They've just become poor excuses for impoverished vocabularies and violent, aggressive language. That's all they are. And you should avoid them, not because of the pornography factor, simply because it's not nice language. It's uneducated, but it's also thuggery. It's verbal thuggery. If I describe last night's very, very riotous storm, let's say with the winter, and then I describe the very piquant and delicious pie that my wife made for Shabbos, and the exhilarating first day in yeshiva, I've applied 3 or 4 adjectives to different experiences. Not possessing a vocabulary, most people just say it was an effing pie and an effing storm and an effing day. And it's just embarrassing. I'm embarrassed to hear. I'm embarrassed to hear curse words. I really am. You're more than that. Speak like a thug. Speak like a cretin. Just generate the words. Just say something. It reminds me when they're interviewing the basketball players in the locker room. And coach's philosophy, and my philosophy, and our philosophy. I say, come on, Socrates is turning over in his grave. You're not a philosopher. You're a pinhead high school dropout who gets paid exorbitant sums to throw balls through hoops. You're not a philosopher. You mean the game plan. You mean the strategy. My philosophy. Like, my goodness, Plato must be stabbing himself in his grave. What's become of my philosophy? My philosophy. Your philosophy. It's the same thing with your language. Do you take your Tzelem Elokim seriously? Do you want to speak and write in glowing terms? That's what's happening in Noach. Listen to me carefully. The word tameh is not pornographic. Describing an animal as tameh is not nibble peh. And still the Torah wants to avoid it. Still the Torah wastes letters that are at a premium not to write the word tameh. Why? Not because it's nibble peh. What's wrong with tameh? It's just not lashon naki. It's not clear, untainted, gallant, noble language. Source number Gimel. Matzinu, line 3, She'ikim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shtayim V'Shalosh Tevos. Hashem wastes extra words and letters. K'dei Shelo Lahotzi Davar Tuma Mitoch Piv. Not to say the word Tameh, especially about animals that are creating a whole new world. This is a momentous occasion. These are the grandparents of all the animal kingdom. You walk outside, you see a cat tonight. That cat's Alter Zedi was in the Teva. And that cat's going to be described as a tame cat. The founding cat of all the modern world. Describe it as tame. How does David begin to heal him? He describes avoiding the evildoers, the corrupt, the lazy, the cynics. Ashrei ish. Asher lo halach batzas v'shayim. Who doesn't follow the evil. It's a backwards way. The Pasuk should not say fortune is the one that doesn't associate. What should David say? What's a clearer way to say it? You're cursed if you follow their ways and associate with them. Why does he create a grammatically awkward beginning to Tehillim? Asher ish asher lo alach batzas v'shayim v'derachatam lo amar v'moshe v'leitzim lo yashav. He wastes his words and it's grammatically very, very awkward. It's not elegant. Ashri is a show low. When I begin the yeshiva by saying, you'll be successful in Gush if you don't do this, and I'll tell you what you have to do. Of course, there are boundaries, parameters, but so what would it be to begin Sefer Tehillim with the word Ara? How many micro arts, micro calligraphies on people's wall? Imagine you had that first word in boldface, Ara. Ashri! Fortunate, glowing, positive. Anyone learn the beginning of Psachim? Come on, it's a high school favorite. What's the first word of Pesach's Psachim?
Or le'ar basar, bokin es hametz le'ar. That takes the Gemara 2 blot. You gotta sue your high school for refund. Takes the Gemara 2 blot to scratch his head to decode or. Because you, I, and everyone in the street would think or le'ar basar means the day of the 14th, which would mean perform b'dikas hametz erev Pesach. But if we look at this pasuk and that pasuk, or can sometimes mean the night. So we perform b'dikas hametz the night before the 14th, or le'ar basar. Are you kidding me? Why not just come out and say it? Why confuse us? Just write, Laila Arbasar, Bokinas Achamitz, Laran Air. Why confuse us? Same thing. Could you imagine the Masechta that describes our Geula and Yitzias Mitzrayim begins with the word Laila? It should begin with the word R. What, Laila's pornographic? Laila's Nibble Peh? Tameh is Nibble Peh? Aru is Nibble. It's not. It's just not Lashon Naki. It's not eloquent. It's not elegant. It's not noble. You're embarrassed to speak that way. Something to work on, guys. Probably something which is latent in your mind, in your consciousness, and you find the less you hear it, the less inclined you are to say it. I'm in no way diminishing the problems of cursing. And anyway, I want to clarify for you, to distill it. It's not Nibble Peh. This is the whole challenge of pornography. What you think about, what you view with your eyes, what you speak about with your tongue, what you write about. That's one issue that we talked about earlier in the year, and we continue to talk. Then there's another issue, just not cursing, just because it just doesn't become you. Not appropriate for whom you are. Generally, it's said in anger. It's said in deprecation. It's not said when you're reciting a Milton poem. It's not said when you're reciting a Dvar. So words that are just used as aggressive, as disparaging, of people, of experiences, and it's a poor excuse for vocabulary. So it's just basically you've reduced your vocabulary to one modifier, so your whole world collapsed. Like having a conversation with 100 words. So you have a conversation, anytime you want to describe a modifier, you say the word F, and anytime you want to describe something you don't like, say the word S. And it's verbal impoverishment. There's one other factor I want to relate to very, very quickly. It's a little bit related to Lashon Naki. One of the dangers of social media, and I'll speak a little bit about social media in this room as well, being that there aren't that many rabbinic figures who are engaged in social media, although it's growing, Baruch Hashem, sometimes it's hard for people to hear healthy, sophisticated, reasonable responses to some of the dangers. Remember, this is all worthless, and you shouldn't be involved at all, and it's all Bitul Torah and Gilui Arayos, and we know it is, and we know that it can be used productively. So what are the more subtle dangers? It's easier to get likes and to attract people and traffic if you say something negative or something destabilizing or anti-authority. In fact, the whole ethos, the whole culture of social media is anti-authority. It's to be there are official outlets of information, the news, the Channel 2 News, the New York Times, the Daily Chronicle. And these were the purveyors of information. And now we've empowered ourselves that each person can deliver their own information. You can call whatever information suits you. There are many, many dangers to that. The echo chamber and other challenges. But the whole premise of social media is we're no longer dependent upon the classic institutionalized outlets of information. And that's why in its initial stages, social media fueled a lot of revolutions and certainly the Arab Spring, the Arab Uprising, 2011, social media, others, obviously. Can't control information anymore. We have ways to rally and to exchange information that can skirt governmental controls. That combination that social media fuels people's appetite to be acknowledged, to be recognized. I got a like, I got another like. How many likes did you get? How many friends do you have? Combined with, you'll see a lot of very, very negative, the whole culture of videos of fail videos, embarrassing videos where... That's part of the danger. Become a positive person. Speak positively about people. Respect them. The words you write about them. The way you treat them. It's very subtle, but that's the real danger once you get past the obvious, how you use your time and what you're watching. Feel that are very engaged sometimes are looking for attention, which in and of itself is a danger that expresses itself on other fronts. But the easiest way to get attention is to say something
negative or carping or critical or satirical or making fun of. It's a very, very violent, aggressive world of ideas we live in, where people shout at each other and dismiss each other's values and polarize themselves politically. It's a product of many phenomena, but in part it's being fueled by social media. On many fronts, the veneer that everyone agrees with you, because you create these echo chambers where you just look at the news of your friends, so obviously your friends will write it. As far as I'm concerned, the whole world is Jewish, right? Right? That's all I see on Facebook. It's people having simchos and learning Torah and settling in Israel, right? Everyone's a yeshiva bacher. Like, those are your friends. And able to see other people's ideas and recognize the validity in other people's ideas. But part of it is creating a toxicity of language and of interaction with people that I would associate with Lashon Naki. It's a good thing to work on, guys. I know may not have been successful in high school and surpassing it or overcoming it, now's a good time to work on it for your own benefit. I promise you, on many, many, many fronts, beyond being on Yeshiva Bachur and Oved Hashem, although that would be enough, you'll be a much better person. In general, if your language is carefully checked, in general, if your word usage becomes more elegant, certainly if you're not a cursor, certainly if you don't employ those words, I know you get a rise out of people, it's funny, but people know the difference. People are able to discern the difference. In your workplace, they will respect you. They will respect your integrity. They will respect the way you use your tongue. And if you're a very positive person who avoids negativity, you'll find that as well. Okay, guys. We'll stop here. You're welcome.